Welcome to the Internal Medicine for Vet Techs podcast. If you haven't joined us before, we're passionate about all things internal medicine and helping you become the best tech you can be. We'll be discussing interesting internal medicine diseases, how to work closely with pet parents, and how to become the go-to tech in your practice. Now, let's start the show. Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for listening and making a commitment to your learning. We hope that you are doing well. I'm one of your hosts. I am Yvonne Brandenburg. Jordan is off for this week. She is, spring has sprung. There's a lot of stuff going on with her house, and her hubby is in town, so they're doing a bunch of stuff this weekend. But I am joined by the lovely Christine Weaver. Hello, Christine.
Well, hello, Yvonne. It is good to be here. And I'm so glad to be joining you as our listeners are on their journey to continuing learning as well.
Yes. So I'm excited because Christine and I, we worked together a year and a half, 2 years. I don't know. It seems like a long time, but when I calculated, I was like, oh, that wasn't that long.
Yeah, I think it was like 2.5 years. Yeah. It may have been longer because there was a lot of that gray area for
the
a while.
Weird overlap. Yeah. But I roped her into this conversation because she just left me for somewhere else. And so I was like, well, I can't not talk to you. So you want to be on the podcast? She was like, yeah, why not? So I'm excited. Christine, if you don't know who Christine Weaver is, because she does speak at conferences, so she's not like a nobody. She's pretty cool. So Christine, she has her LVT and her VTS in internal medicine neurology. So she's got her neurology VTS. She has been doing this for over 20 years. And we'll put her bio in the show notes so you can see it. You've had your VTS now since 2012.
Yep.
And then you got your bachelor's in 2022 in biobehavioral health, which is a whole other subject that we could rabbit hole on too, because we have.
Yes.
But that is not today.
It is the best health model out there.
Right. I agree, girl. But she's currently I love her title, which is why I have to say it. She's the learning and development trailblazer for partner veterinary emergency and specialty over on the East Coast. Whatever. She should come over here, but she's never going to. It's fine.
Nope.
She's like, I'm stuck on the East Coast. But yeah, and she, let's see, you've talked at like ACVM and all sorts of fun stuff. You did our conference back in November. Mm-hmm. Was it November, October? I don't know, sometime last year. And this subject that we're talking about today is kind of a fun one that you've talked about at the conferences and we've talked mm-hmm. about just in general. And Christine also does a ton of mentoring for getting VTS, and this subject is super relatable for that. Am I missing anything about you for now?
Oh, Lord in heaven. Well, I mean, yes, but no. Anything relevant? Probably not. No. Nobody needs to know that I named a wild squirrel Olaf and I'm trying to make him my friend. My love of dinosaurs.
Amazing.
Yeah. All of those things are, I think, pretty
she irrelevant. Said that very throwaway, like her love of dinosaurs, like very like cash, like her. No, if you know anything about Christine, she is a dinosaur and relates to them a lot. A lot. We called her C-Rex.
Yes.
No, or Weaversaurus. So she's definitely a dinosaur.
One of those people, yeah. If you want to talk dinosaurs, I will do it all day, but you might need to come correct because otherwise it's gonna be a long conversation of like, first of all, that wasn't even a dinosaur.
I love when you send me like pictures and you're like, look at this shit. And I'm like, oh god, I'm sorry. They like have the wrong thing listed, but I'm angry with you. Which is actually, it's really funny because one thing that we've been nerding out about is the fact that I have my chickens right now and they are 1,000% mini dinosaurs in my bathroom right now.
It's, yeah, I mean, that's one thing that, like, we joke, or you may have heard, like, oh, you know, birds are kind of like dinosaurs, or dinosaurs evolved into birds. And, you know, the reality is if you read any scientific literature, which we'll obviously discuss today, you'll always see them kind of identify like avian dinosaurs versus non-avian dinosaurs, because modern day birds, all modern day birds, are actually an offshoot of the theropod clade, which also gave rise to things like your raptors and your Tyrannosauridae. So, I mean, birds are by definition dinosaurs. They are modern day dinosaurs. They're just not the non-avian, really cool, you know, ornithischian or ceratopodomorph type dinosaurs. They're just the cute ones.
That was just a taste, guys. Yeah. We could do a whole podcast episode just on like dinosaurs with Christine.
Tempt me.
If there's any other dinosaur crazy, she will do that. That could be your podcast.
Absolutely. Vote now if you'd like to hear a completely nerded out, somehow internal medicine related dinosaur podcast. You will make my day.
I'm sure there's somebody in the audience. Just saying. Oh my God, it's so funny. Okay, I have to do my housekeeping really quick before I get in trouble. So for housekeeping, just a reminder, just real quick, for April of 2024, we are doing our monthly CE April 13th, and it's going to be Pain, Recognize and Advocate for Veterinary Patients. And then in May, we're doing a text guide to managing the diabetic ketoacidosis patient. So if you're an internal medicine for vet techs member, remember, this is free with your membership. Then if you are not a member, you can always join us. You can buy a ticket to join us, and everything's race approved. So you do get an hour of CE for joining. I'm trying to think of anything else. Jordan usually reminds me of things, so I'm going to say no because I can't remember things. So if there is something else I should be talking about, I'm trying to think of anything else before we kind of dive into a super nerdy subject. We'll segue into it, right? One of the reasons that Christine and I had been talking about this, and I said, yes, I think this is a really good subject. When, you know, if you're going for a VTS or even just like as your credentialed technician, you know, we need to make sure that we understand how to find resources. And we kind of were joking before we started recording that people think that we're really smart. And I mean, we're okay smart, but we freaking know how to research. So I think that's the biggest thing is, and this is not just in medicine, veterinary medicine. It's in like everything, right? Is being able to evaluate the resources that you're using, right? And making sure that they are appropriate, making sure it's not an opinion. Cause I did go to your lecture at ACBAM and I was like, cool. And just making sure that you're getting the proper information. And it's hard, right? There's so much information out there on the web. It's not like when I was a kid, and so Jordan probably can't relate to this. When I was a kid, if I wanted to learn something, I had to go to the Encyclopedia Britannica on my shelf that my parents had.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. And then if you didn't know how to spell something, it's like, go look it up in the dictionary. And I always like, it's like, I don't know how to do that. If I don't know how to spell it, how do I find it? It was like the worst. For all of you 80s and before babies, you can relate to this.
We're here with you.
Right. So anyways, that is why we're talking about this subject. And Christine's going to completely nerd out, which I love. And then I'll throw my 2 cents in every once in a while, and I'm sure I'll ask more questions because that's how it works. All right, Christine, let's dive right into this bad boy.
I'm excited to talk about this. I feel like for a number of reasons, because there are a number of reasons, one, to kind of know science and to understand scientific literature, With regards to internal medicine and being a vet tech, yeah, your VTS application, we absolutely require references, particularly of scientific literature. So if you don't know what you're looking for with regards to those kinds of references, whether it's primary, secondary, or tertiary literature, it may be very difficult. And for me, anything that's an obstacle in the way of somebody who wants to get their VTS that doesn't include they don't have enough hours or they don't have the skill set or something like that, I want to remove that. So I talk to people a lot about scientific literature for that reason. But there are other reasons to understand scientific literature. And really, one, reading it for fun, as far as I'm concerned, but also just kind of understanding it. And that could be anything from getting your VTS application, career pathing. So you want to become a writer, you want to get into presentations, you need to be able to substantiate whatever points that you're trying to make. Yeah. And that is particularly important if you're trying to make any points that are paradigm breaking. So for example, if I'm going to a conference and I'm a neurotech, just throwing it out there, hypothetically, I'm a neurotech, I am 100% going to tell you, you need to start using ketamine on your brain patients, unless it's obstructive hydrocephalus. But we've had it ingrained in our minds that we cannot use ketamine on any brain patients for so long that you better believe I'm going to be showing up with a lot of resources to tell you why.
This isn't a hypothetical, by the way.
This isn't a hypothetical.
You're not using her do this exact same thing.
Yeah, this is an exact example. Stop avoiding ketamine in your brain patients. If you have questions, contact us. I'd be more than happy to just throw it all down your throat. And there are reasons for it. And so I might know, based on my experience, based on the research, but I have to be able to ensure that my audience, whether it's writing, whether it's training, whether it's a VTS application, that my audience understands that I know and that what I'm talking about isn't just some sort of a personal opinion.
Yeah.
And I think this really became a passionate subject of mine, in part because I actually like reading scientific literature. I hate to break it to the audience. You could not bore me more with fiction stuff. It's not that I hate fiction. It's just that I'm not going to be picking up 50 Shades of Grey anytime soon. Never read it, never fell.
I love that that's what you're going to pick up on.
I don't know. Choose a title that's really popular and common now. It's like TV. I don't know what's popular.
Jurassic Park.
Okay, that's different because it's dinosaurs.
Sorry, I'm going to derail her today. That's my goal.
It's not hard, folks. I apologize in advance. But, you know, the pandemic really brought to light just how little we as a society or we as a culture understand research.
Yeah.
And that's not, you know, yes, you're going to hear some soapbox moments from me today. So it's not that I want to say we don't know anything and nobody knows. It's more just to kind of bring to light things that I think, particularly us in veterinary medicine, we already know. You know, our opinions, our presentations, and what we're training and educating on needs to be evidence-based. But if the evidence that we're using is not good, then our points are not good.
I think we've also compared to the general populace, like we've had to learn how to, you know, evaluate resources.
Right.
And it's not an intuitive skill for a lot of people. So yeah, I think you're totally right. Like we are a little better at it, but we can definitely be even better.
We can be even better. And I think too, and we'll talk about things like crap testing and all of that. But the other thing that I think is really important for people to understand is that just because something that you knew 5 or 10 years ago is true has been disproven, that doesn't mean science didn't work. That's one of the most ugly things that I saw on social media, was how much people are like, trust science. Oh, science said this. Yeah. And then more science said that that's not true. Right. And I'll talk a little bit about Descartes. Descartes had real serious issues with this, but at the end of the day, what we now know, chances are, is going to be disproven as wrong or incomplete as we move forward.
Yeah.
And so as we talk about the scientific process, you'll understand why that's the case and why that's actually good. Because as we grow in one field, we are also going to be able to apply that knowledge into other fields. And we know that every day in vet med, right? Like, how many times do we're like, oh, we do this in human med.
Yeah.
You know, neurology specifically. In vet med, we said, oh, EEG is antiquated technology. Well, no, it's not. There is actually value to it. And we know that because human medicine still uses it. If it was actually antiquated, human medicine would not be using EEG. Now, they use it for some different reasons, and it is more limited in vet med, but it's still very valuable in vet med. So that's one way that we kind of already know, oh, yes, we take information and knowledge from one field and we can apply it to ours, or we can apply it to ours that we then continue to move forward with and say, okay, now we better understand this. Look at degenerative myelopathy and ALS. Joan Coates actually works with ALS foundations because degenerative myelopathy and ALS are so closely related. We can actually use degenerative myelopathy as a model, a translational model for studying ALS. So we know there's crossover. And so we're not siloed in vet med. And so as other technologies and other things come to light, we're going to start using those. We're going to research those and we're going to learn more and we're going to move forward. What we have to get comfortable with as human beings is that sometimes means that we're going, what we know now, not going to be true moving forward. And that's where I think people get really uncomfortable. The idea, and Descartes was the same way, the idea that something that I know now is the truth, and then one day finding out it was never true. It was just what we thought was to be true. I'll talk about Descartes in a minute, but like,
there's so many things in vet med that that relates to.
And it's really true. Right? Like ketamine in brain patients, scruffing cats.
How we do CPR, what size catheter we place in patient. I mean, there's so many things that it's like that whole thing that people say that once you know better, do better.
Right? Exactly.
Like you have that information that is like accurate and correct now, but medicine is constantly evolving, which is why it's required to do CE. If it wasn't constantly evolving, you wouldn't have to do CE. You could just get your degree and that's it. You know everything forever. But it's always evolving, which is one reason why we probably love it.
Exactly. Exactly.
You're constantly learning things and applying it, which is really cool. Yeah.
And that's where too, we have to tweak our mindset. And I hope people listening to this are able to do this, where we have to tweak our mindset away from what's popular in society. What's popular in society is to put up walls and barriers and find ways to say, no, I wasn't wrong. And I think that's a product of our public education system. You know, we grew up saying, you memorize these certain things. This is what I need you to put on the test. And we equate getting answers wrong with failure and being bad. So we've psychologically grown into this mindset that says failing is bad. I mean, failing can be bad. Don't get me wrong. But instead of coming at it from a point of learning, we're just like, no, it's bad. And we do everything we can psychologically to protect ourselves from that kind of a negative emotion. So we just say, no, it can't be that I'm wrong. It's that you're wrong and you're lying. You're a conspiracy theorist or you're working for some big, like there's just people put these barriers in place. So my big thing that I tell people about science is be both skeptical and open-minded. Yeah. And hopefully, you know, by the time we're done today, I'm able to provide people with some of the tools or at least some of the mindset to kind of flip the switch from, okay, what I know now, like it sucks. It sucks. Like I grew up in that time frame of being like scruff cats. They like it. Now I knew my cat hated it. You scruff him. That was the last time you were going to touch him that day. So why in my mind did I hold on to, I'm sure this is fine. I'm sure this is fine. We now know that's obviously not fine.
Yeah.
That the idea, if I can just hold them down long enough, I mean, shoot, there was a time where we didn't think animals even felt pain.
Right.
And so imagine that paradigm break in vet med. That was before my time in vet med, but imagine that paradigm break where you had to convince veterinarians and vet techs, like actually you need to give them pain meds because what you're doing is kind of cruel. And they probably had that same resistance.
Yeah. I worked with a old school cowboy vet that that's and I was like no I refuse to work with him, stop it.
And thankfully I did work with a vet that had been in the industry for many years at that point, but this was a man that I kind of carry his mindset along with me my entire career, which was you're always, you can always learn. We should always be teachable. Mm-hmm. And that's where things like scientific literature and science really can help us. So for me, I feel like this kind of information is really important because science is how we need to attain some of our knowledge. I'm not eliminating those of very religious and spiritual people. I support you. I hear you. Follow that. But with regards to our jobs, I think that's how we're going to be able to apply something objectively. For me, and this is a very philosophical, only almost spiritual side of it, is to me, science is in a way how we pursue truth. I don't necessarily believe that all truth is knowable, and certainly not all truth within my lifetime is knowable.
Yeah.
But the pursuit of that to me is very exciting.
Yeah.
And again, we want to keep pursuing it. We'll talk about how science is an active process because we're pursuing truth, but maybe we missed the mark. Maybe because our technology wasn't there yet. Mm. Maybe because the way that previous science was done was not to the best of our abilities. So for me, it's always that pursuit of truth. And to your point, when we know better, we can do better, even if it's not perfect.
Yeah.
So let's twist our mindsets away from, but if I knew it now, like, how could it be wrong? And somebody must have lied to me.
Or this is how we've always done it.
Yep. As we learned more, as we know more, I'm going to do more better, which I apologize to English majors out there. That sounded awful. Don't edit that out. Just let people know that's how I talk.
But we like doing things more better.
I like doing things more better because I'm SMRT. So the one thing I do want to make sure people are aware of, though, as we continue moving forward, is that by the end of this, you are not going to be an expert at the nuance of study designs, the flaws. I come from a place of trying to believe that people come from a positive intent, but obviously we do know. I mean, you had people like Andrew Wakefield who falsified his information to try and say that, you know, MMR vaccines caused autism. So we know that there are people out there that are going to do that. You're not going to be able to parcel through that kind of information and say, well, clearly this scientist is lying. And you're also not going, you're just not going to be an expert at evaluating. I had to do it for several years straight in my biobehavioral health degree because everything we did had to be support. I mean, geez, my discussion post had to have like 5 APA resources. So I don't even consider myself an expert. I'm just well read enough that I can look at something and go, or yeah, that seems right. Or not so sure about this. The other thing is that I do give examples, and my examples are not meant to sway your opinion on anything veterinary medicine or otherwise. They're truly just examples of, you know, scientific literature or how things have changed. So I don't want you guys to sit like, no, I personally don't scruff cats. No, I don't believe the evidence supports that scruffing cats is appropriate anymore. But if you're the kind of person who's just like, I love scruffing cats, that is what I do, my whole point is not about scruffing cats, is what I'm saying. We're here to talk about kind of the concepts around science and scientific literature. Where I usually try and reset or develop mindsets around science is trying to ask people for like just a moment, right? Like, how do you know what it is that you know? How did you learn it? And so the fun thought experiment I like taking people through is like, how do you know what day it is? Like, how do you know today is Sunday?
Don't.
Right?
Because Google tells me so.
Exactly. So Google tells you that.
Like, and I don't know what day of the week it is.
And it's really kind of an interesting concept because if you think back, really the only reason you know what day it is because everybody else told you what day it is. Mm-hmm. And at some point you entered into a classroom, probably preschool or daycare. They told you what day it is. And this is the way the days go. And we just keep running through the motions 7 days a week. And we put all those weeks into a month. We put all those months, like basically somebody told us and we just perpetuated this idea that today is Sunday or whatever day you're listening to this. I don't really know. I don't know how you know what day it is of the day that you're listening to this.
We're recording on a Sunday.
We're recording on a Sunday, today, ladies and gentlemen. So we're going to go with Sunday for right now, which that's a whole other rabbit hole we won't go down.
Yeah.
About like different perspectives and such. But so, and really for a whole long time, That's how we knew what we knew. Some really smart or important person, dead, not dead, king, priest, whomever, said, this is the way it is. And you go, that, yep, that's it. That's, we're just going to keep going with that.
Right.
And you just go on with your
merry life. Because there was no Google.
Well, there was no Google, no, especially when we start talking about, you know, people like Aristotle or Socrates or things like that. Like, no, there was no Google. You basically, I mean, particularly back in the time of philosophers, and to me, again, science is in a way philosophy. You know, philosophy really is, it's the love of wisdom. Doesn't that make you love philosophy even more? And there are tons of different types of philosophies out there. I mean, people just sitting around talking about, you know, themselves, like, what is the concept of self? What, why do we exist? They are fun. If you ever just want to have fun thought experiments, go down these rabbit holes. They're heaps good fun. But at the end of the day, that's how we knew knowledge, is a really smart person or the church told us or monarchy told us. We didn't question. We just moved forward with life.
Right.
And I think one of the most fun examples of that when we start thinking about this, and especially as it relates to medicine in general, is things like the humoral theory of medicine, right? So this
one, by the way, you don't see this, but I see her PowerPoint and there is a picture of a soapbox. So just so you know, she's about to soapbox.
I'm about to soapbox on y'all. We already started on this soapbox. I'm sort of stepping up on it. Actually, I love working out. So this may be a box jump at this point. But again,
true.
So, but right. So you think like before the Enlightenment, we just took people's words for it. And we took people's words for it because we put them in our minds or threat of death in positions of power. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so somebody's illness is because they were possessed by an evil spirit and they need an exorcism.
Yeah.
Unlikely, but I can't see evil spirits. Maybe I just don't have the technology. Maybe that's something we learn in the next few hundred years. But I'm going to say, for sake of argument, evil spirits do not cause things like diseases and seizures. And so we kind of just said, yep, that's the correct answer. And we moved on with our lives. Yeah. And the reason why I have a picture of a soapbox here, which nobody can see right now,
I can,
is because we, for some weird reason, are reverting back to this. We're getting back to this idea of a psychology of us versus them. And so if you're on the us side, you know, I'm, what do they call it? I heard somewhere where they called it tribal psychology, but I don't know if that's the correct term or an appropriate term, where basically if this person believes the same things I believe, then I'm overly accepting of anything else they say. I don't, you know, argue with it. I just go, yeah, but you know what? Yvonne's really smart, so I'm sure she's correct. Or Christine's really smart, I'm sure she's correct. You don't look behind, you don't look further than that. Conversely, if people run up to somebody that does not believe the same thing they believe, they're overwhelmingly and unreasonably skeptical of everything that they say, to the point of being unable to accept anything that they have to say, even if it's correct, even if it's something that may align with
their own. I'm going to blame algorithms for that.
And that's part of it. That's absolutely.
That's a whole other conversation.
I hate hive minds.
Ugh.
Most people who know me personally know that I read right-wing media, central, and left-wing media. And the reason is that I worry about ever being in a hive mind. And if I'm on social media like Facebook, I've got an algorithm. If I'm on Instagram, I've got an algorithm. They're only going to show me the things that align with me.
Google has an algorithm.
Exactly. So if I continue down that rabbit hole, I'm never going to see all perspectives. But that's probably a rabbit hole we don't need to go. That's a whole philosophical thing that I have.
What's that soapbox, girl?
That is part of my soapbox, is that we shouldn't just, and if you agree with me on things, you think I'm great and smart, and so you just take my word for everything, I am honored. But I do think it's appropriate that, especially if there's anything that you're like, that seems odd, research it. One of the things that I talk about at Partner when I come in and I train, which I had one training day because I just started this week, is I say, I'm like, I am not an authoritarian with knowledge. If I say something that doesn't seem to jive with what you think is correct, or you want to know more, go research it. And if you find evidence that I'm wrong, bring it to me, because I want to see it. I do not want to be one of those unquestioning, we just do whatever Weaver says, because, you know, that makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So really, we shouldn't, if we're looking at the scientific mind, what you do in your personal life is up to you. And I support you in whatever you feel is good for your mental health and your social health and just overall health. But when we're talking about science and how we perform medicine, it really does need to be evidence-based. We can't just say, oh, but I really love Yvonne and Christine, so everything they say must be true. I'm going to listen to them. That's why I give people resources to look up after me. Yeah. Don't like what I have to say? There's my resource. What don't you like about it? Let's have a conversation. I'm one of those few people that I'm okay being uncomfortable, being proven wrong, if that means that I know better and can do better.
Right. Yeah.
So that's really in contrast with how we are in society. Like I said, we put up these obstacles the second we find out we could be wrong. And you see this very much around COVID pandemic, vaccines, ivermectin, QAnon, like whatever it is out there, people don't like to find out that they may not have had the whole truth, that they believe something that wasn't the whole truth. And I think it's because it comes back to our public education where we're like, oh, that means I'm stupid. No, it doesn't mean you're stupid. It means that the evident information that was available to you at the time led you to that conclusion. Now we have better information. Descartes was different though. This boy, let me tell you, there's a great video. I'll put a link to this video because it's a great crash course. One day I'll get it right. Edit it, don't edit it. This is how I talk, people. But Descartes, so Rene Descartes, he came in prior to the Enlightenment. But he got, I don't want to say furious, but boy, was he upset when he found out that he truly wholeheartedly believed something that turned out to not be true. And for me, I just go, okay, wow, eat my words. Know better, do better. Know better, do better. That's the way I'm going to move forward. But he was like, F that. I'm going to unbelieve everything I've ever learned. Like, imagine like you got like a basket of apples and you just go, I got one bad apple in here. I'm throwing them all out. And the only apples that I'm going to go ahead and put back in my basket are going to be ones that I know for sure, undyingly know, are correct. And the only way I can know it is if I see it and touch it and smell it for myself. Cool idea. Imagine, and he's not the only one who has done these thought experiments. Imagine unlearning everything you've learned with the exception of things that you know to be true because it's been in front of you. I have never been to Antarctica. But I've also never questioned Antarctica's existence because I've seen it on TV. I've seen pictures. Yeah. I also wouldn't understand the real reason to make up a continent. Be that as it may, I've never seen it before. So those are the kinds of things that he was like, okay, if I can see it and feel it, I'm going to put it back in. And it's kind of a way that we started lending ourselves into the scientific method, which when we actually get down to the true scientific or the true definition of science, I'll say why that is. But again, he was really upset about, like, it really bothered him. So I don't think it's abnormal for us to be upset about the idea that something that we thought was true is no longer true.
Yeah.
I mean, shoot, we used to line houses with asbestos. This is safe. Now your house won't burn down. I mean, you're going to get mesothelioma, but you're right. Your house won't burn down.
Yeah.
So this happens all the time. This is a very normal process. Yeah. And I'll give you some more examples later. And there are other philosophers that really helped us in the Enlightenment. John Locke is another one. And I love this. Again, you can tell how much, to me, science and philosophy are intertwined. But he had a publication, The Essay Concerning Human Understanding. And he says that humans are born like a blank sheet of paper. We have no innate knowledge, but special powers to adapt ourselves to the physical and social environment. Yes, 100% agree.
Yeah, I agree.
And keep in mind, this is also before Darwin. And then he says that meaningful language is connected to the ideas we acquire, and that talking about things of which we know nothing is a source of serious intellectual errors. It's kind of harsh, but... yeah. When you start talking about stuff you ain't got no knowledge on, why the hell are you opening your mouth? And so so there are obviously many other philosophers and that were out there, like Thomas Hobbes and George Berkeley, David Hume. So to say it's just these two is an entire lie. But these are a couple of the great minds that I'm kind of bringing into this, just because you have Descartes, who's like, the source of human knowledge is reason, right? okay, so what I know is what I can put in front of me. I have a logical system. I know this to be true. Human knowledge is reason. John Locke saying the source of human knowledge is experience, which is also the scientific method, that we put things in front of us, we go through the process. Aha, this is how we know things. So, you know, when we talk about the Enlightenment and really kind of opening up our eyes to what scientific method could be, getting away from being like, oh, well, if Socrates said this, that like 500 years ago, it's probably fine. The king said it, so it's cool. We actually started becoming a much more skeptical society. We started challenging things that we otherwise would have accepted both implicitly and explicitly. So that's when we started to see a period of rigorous scientific and political and philosophical discourse. People actually sat down and started discussing things and working through things to try and get to the truth. Ergo, philosophy, love of wisdom, pursuit of truth. They wanted to start using actual objective information to discover truth. And to say it started off perfectly is an absolute lie, but I'm not going to go through that level of history. The idea was we wanted to solve the problem of quote-unquote darkness. We wanted to solve the problem of injustice, and we wanted to solve tyranny. So you can start to see, wow, you know, 1685 to 1815, a lot of stuff happened politically during that time, up to and including this country's own sense of independence. So there was a lot of reason why we wanted to bring science in, not just because we wanted to know stuff and not be ignorant, but we also used it to fight things like injustices and tyranny. So it's really was a really exciting time. And that's when we really start to see the rise of us using empiricism. And we even have, there's a study of everything. Epistemology is just the study of knowledge. And I'm like, that sounds cyclical, but fine, that's what it is. But that's where we start to see more of the scientific method. How do we use our senses to observe and interact with our environment in a way that we can use that information to learn more about it, as opposed to being like, that dude seems smart. I'm a listen to him. I'm sure he's good. Or that guy said it's that way. And if I don't agree, I'm gonna get murdered. So I'm just gonna go with that.
Nice. Yeah. Great. Now you're making me say, don't listen to this podcast, but we do. But we put resources in the show.
Listen to the podcast, because if you disagree with me because of the podcast, that's awesome. As long as you have evidence to do it, now I'm getting you to get up and instead of saying I don't believe this woman, she don't know what she's talking about, you're actually going to be like, not only does she not know what she's going to talk about, but I'm going to go ahead and get resources to prove her wrong.
Oh my God. And she'll love it. By the way, you can always send me an email and I'll pass it along.
Yeah. All I ask is that it's respectful. I like respectful discourse. I have had conversations on various topics that I will not discuss here on this channel or really at all ever publicly with people who are diametrically opposed to what I think. And I'm telling you, I have done this with people on the far, far left. I have done this with Southern Baptists. So, and I always come out on the other side, still having a respectful relationship with that person. It can be done. And I think we need to get back to doing more of that. But that's a soapbox that we're not going to talk about. But I also find that to me, there's always a comfort in science and objectivity, right? Like, because then it's not anything personal. It's just, oh, what this is what the information says. And science, it was interesting. I remember in class, they asked us to define science. And I'm like, like, if you think about it for a second, how do you define science? You know, for me, science is something that is logical. It's skeptical. It's trying to pursue the truth, even if we haven't gotten to the truth yet. But my favorite quote that I've seen that what science is, and really this is just the scientific method, is, you know, fuck around and find out. Like, you have to dive in to find out. So true. I'm like, actually, that's probably the best way to describe science. F around and find out. But if we're going to be adults, because I guess we have to be, I will give you actual definitions. Okay. So when we look at what the Oxford Dictionary says, which I always put a dictionary definition of something in because I think it's a good starting point for negotiations. And science is is said to be the intellectual and practical activity encompassing the systematic study of the structure and behavior of the physical and natural world through observation and experiment. And what you can't see on my slide is that there's some words that I have underlined, which is practical activity, observation, and experiment.
Yeah.
There is a website, an organization out there called the Science Council, which, cool. I am not qualified to join their stuff, their organization, but they have a lot of really cool information on there. And they define science as the pursuit and application of knowledge and understanding of the natural and social world following a systematic methodology based on evidence. I love that definition.
That's a good one.
Because it's not only a pursuit, so it's a pursuit and application, so it is active, and it's an understanding, so there is the knowledge in there. And it's using a systematic methodology that's based on evidence. So we're still trying to get knowledge. We're still trying to apply knowledge, but we're going to do it with specific kinds of evidence. So, I mean, yeah, back to my F around and find out. I guess it's F around, find out, and then flip and apply it. Like, maybe it's that. You can quote me on that. Put my face next to it.
Oh my God, I love it.
If that's what I'm known for after I pass away from this world, I will be such a happy camper.
Right.
So science, and we'll get to the literature, guys. Okay, just bear with me, but let's understand science and everything behind it, because then we can get into the boring stuff. So it's active, it's objective and evidence-based, but it's also going to be appropriately challenged. And that's what's not listed in those previous definitions, is that it needs to be challenged. So, and when I say challenge, much like I said to you guys out there, if you disagree with me on something and you want to discuss it, the only thing I ask is that we're respectful. So yeah, you don't come just out there and start yelling and screaming at me or using names. I'll just block people. I have no interest. I have an interest in pursuing the truth. And that sometimes means having long conversations with people you don't necessarily agree with, as long as it's respectful. But you know, it's active in that, again, it involves investigation and reinvestigation as technology and knowledge changes in all disciplines. And I'll give you some great dinosaur examples coming up. It's objective and evidence-based. We should be using some level of empiricism to justify the beliefs of what we hold or why we're doing what we're doing. And I frequently use that in training, is that if I come up and let's say I've trained somebody to do something, and they're doing it a completely different way, the first question out of my mouth is always, can you take me through your process? Because it may very well be that their process is 20 times better than what I was discussing in a training plan. Right. So I'd rather know. Or if they're just like, I don't know, it feels warm and fuzzy, I might be like, okay, let's talk about why we need evidence for what we're doing. And there really needs to be transparency to that evidence. And that's where scientific literature comes in. You know, I can tell you statistics, I can tell you context, I can tell you all those things that you want, but scientific literature should be how we get the transparency on how we got that information. And with all of those things, because it's objective, because it's evidence-based, and we're transparent with how we're getting that evidence, it should be repeatable. So a person, and they did a recent study in Europe and Finland, and they actually said that they were studying a particular social phenomenon here in the United States, but they were studying it in Finland. They had an N of like 5,000 people. And they flat out said, hey, we recognize that like this really applies to Finland, even though this is primarily a US cultural thing. And so they invited US researchers like, here's how we did it. We think you should do it there. And that's science. That's you can repeat everything that you did and let's see if the results are the same. And then again, lastly, you know, things need to be appropriately challenged. The status quo does not last very long. The half-life of knowledge in medicine in general, at least as was as part of Sam, I think it was Abramson, I think he published back in 2012. So it's been a long time, that the half-life of knowledge in medicine is about 5 years. And of course, that's going to vary. You know, if you're talking about interventional or genetic-based cancer treatments, it's not gonna be every 5 years. It's gonna be like every 6 months. Other sciences, though, if you love geology, I'm sorry, I'm just using it as an example, you know, maybe geology is like every 10 years again.
Yeah, it's how established.
Right. And we're finding that as all of our technologies are improving, those half-lives are getting smaller and smaller because we're taking these technologies from other fields and applying them in other ways. So we know status quo is not going to change. That doesn't mean science failed. It means science succeeded. It means that we took this and we got better information out of it because we learned more. And then the other thing about science is that typically, especially if you're talking about scientific literatures, it almost always starts with a question, right?
Mm.
And so we'll talk about that with primary literature as well. But then typically it's kind of like, wait, why? Let's say, for example, why is it we seem to have so many people with autoimmune disease, right? Mm. That could be the question. And so it may be that we're, you know, somebody out there has that question. They're going to challenge maybe normal things that we all consider to be safe and healthy. And then it turns out it's not.
Right. Shoot,
I grew up in the 90s where Sunny D was considered healthy. All right. So, I mean, we know stuff changes. Pop-Tarts. When you start on Pop-Tarts being less healthy than the candy bar. But when I take example, I love to give examples. You guys can't see my dinosaur pictures, which is unfortunate. But, you know, even when we talk about something that seems like it doesn't evolve quickly, it does. So in, for example, actually, I'll use maybe one or two examples. So one example is we always just assume that dinosaurs are millions of years old, or that the fossils are millions of years old. We might find their bones. We'll never know what they look like. Yet come around to 2012 and they find this, I swear if this dinosaur was alive today, this is what I'd be feeding off my back tech trying to make my friend. look up, if you're listening to this, the Sinoceropteryx. This guy was so well preserved that you can see that this dinosaur was literally fuzzy. Fuzzy dinosaur. But even better is that as our technologies in genetic and molecular thingies
understanding
analysis, they actually know what color this thing was. So not only do we know that this was an adorably fuzzy dinosaur, we know that it was ring-tailed, we know that it was countershaded, we know that it was kind of this brownish red up top and kind of a lighter white on the bottom, and he had little rings on his tail. This was a dinosaur squirrel raccoon monkey thing, and I want one. If they're going to bring back a dinosaur, this is the one I want. So it's a great example of how technologies in other industries have actually been brought into other, like, who would have thought genetic analyses or molecular analyses and being able to look at melanosomes and comparably with squid, like this is how we found them. They were originally found in squid or something. And that birds and reptiles have these specific ones and they can just look at the shape of them and say, it's this color. This is what color they were.
Yeah.
Whereas 20 years ago, we would have said, oh, well, we would never know what they look like anyway.
Right.
Or, you know, you look at, even though Jurassic Park admittedly got the Velociraptor really wrong, that was definitely a Deinonychus, but they weren't really 100% sure on, I would have said Utah Raptor, they said Deinonychus, it's fine. But they weren't really sure about feathers at that time. Well, now we know for darn sure that not only was the Velociraptor the size of a turkey, which they knew then in just Hollywood, but that they also had feathers. So there's just a lot of areas.
I'm sorry, you can't convince me that Blue is turkey size and has feathers because Blue is perfect.
Blue may be perfect, but Blue was not a Velociraptor. Blue was Deinonychus and or a Utah Raptor, a very large type of dromaeosaur. Let's also talk about, you know what? No, I'm not. You tried that with me, Yvonne. I'm not going down that rabbit hole.
Don't worry. I'll keep trying.
It's not going to be that hard.
I mean, you put pictures in your PowerPoint of dinosaurs. Like, I wish you guys could see them. They're pretty amazing.
I did. I talk about how the posture of Stegosaurus changed over the last 100 years and what we know that it looks like. And my favorite thing that I added was last year, there are two that was 2021. My bad. No, it is 2023. Oh yeah. Okay. Apparently there's nothing better than a paleontologist convention because fist fights break out. I really want to go to one of these things.
This kills me that there's, I mean, I get it. People are super passionate when they rabbit hole like this, Christine. And so they'll throw down.
But they'll throw down over like, no, my theory's best, my theory's best. And what I love is they all have evidence to support it. So, you know, you've got a couple paleontologists that are like about whether or not Allosaurus was primarily a predator or if it was primarily a scavenger. And both sides provide really interesting evidence. Don't even get me started. Apparently Spinosaurus is also a really hot, like very touchy, divisive subject in the paleontological world, which I think is hilarious. Was it a swimmer? Was it not a swimmer? You know how long it took them to accept those things ate fish? And I'm sure like next week, they're going to be like, yeah, it didn't eat fish. It ate birds. Like. Actually, and it did. It did eat pterosaurs. They found evidence of that. Sorry. So that was a bad example. My point is, clearly getting to it, is that science, again, it's active and it does actually need to be challenged. So, you know, whether you're talking to Yvonne Brandenburg or Christine Weaver or any of the other technician leaders out there, I personally demand respect if you're going to disagree with me on something, but disagreeing with me does not equal disrespect. And so we need to be, in order to get closer to the truth, either in our own minds and in how we practice, we need to be able to support what we're doing and why we're doing with evidence. And so how this kind of relates to this as well is a lot of times on VTS applications, we can see that some technicians really rely heavily on their veterinarians. Like that's where all their information is coming from. And I want to be very clear that I love my veterinarians, even veterinarians I have disagreed with on various levels. I can't do my job without them. Right. Just as they can't do their job without us. So I mean no disrespect when I say that, but ultimately a veterinarian is an expert opinion. And we'll talk about the reliability of expert opinions as it comes to evidence. But, you know, one of the things I like to say too is like back when, you know, philosophy and science discussions over the last few hundred years rarely involved women. They were usually in smoking rooms or big, you know, halls where they're like, I would like to discuss the meaning of life. We don't really do that anymore. I don't go to, well, I mean, I guess we do kind of, right? We go to conferences.
Conferences, oh, yep.
Oh, I got to update that in my talk. Anyway, but if you don't go to conferences, let's say you don't have a CE budget or you don't like travel. I mean, I met somebody that didn't get on an airplane for the first time or left their state until they were in their 30s. So some people just don't want to do that. So scientific literature can truly be a good way for us to stay up to date if you can understand it. So I guess that's how I then make my segue into literature. What is it and what we do, what we use, why and when?
Yeah.
So I think when we, not I think, when we went to school, the most of the way that we learned was from textbooks. Textbooks are considered what we call tertiary evidence. But what I'm going to focus primarily on is going to be primary literature and a little bit of secondary literature. Secondary is my personal favorite, in part because I'm lazy, but we'll talk about what that means in a second. So primary literature is what you're going to read when you're reading like JVIM or JVEC, you know, any of those journals that publish, you know, the actual research. So we call it primary literature because it's the original research. The authors that wrote that article that you're reading out of JVIM are the people that conducted that research. And you will know that you're reading primary literature, one, if you look at the language and go, holy sciencese, Batman.
Yeah.
But also, that's part of it. But the other part is it's going to be identified by what we call the MRAD. So abstract, materials and methods, results, discussion and conclusion. So those are the different sections that you're going to see in primary literature and systematic and reviews and meta-analyses, which is secondary. And these things are really good to stay like up to date, right? So I showed you an example, or I spoke of an example about paleontologists arguing about the Allosaurus and whether or not it was a scavenger or whether or not it was a true predator. So the hard thing with that is that that's really timely. And I'm enjoying this Jerry Springer show that is Allosaurus diet. Like it's fantastic for me. Do you see now why fiction to me is just boring? I'm like, you cannot beat this kind of stuff. So it's very, very timely. But on the other side of it, because it's very, very timely, it can be very hard to discern paradigm breaking information, right? Like they may argue back and forth. And at the end of the day, the evidence goes back to it was a primary carnivore. The other thing is that for us, particularly those of us who don't work heavily in science, it can be a little hard to follow. You have have a good understanding of scientific method, the different type of study designs, what the statistics mean. So they can be a little bit difficult. And then again, as I said, by the end of this, we're not going to be experts on evaluating literature. So it can be kind of hard to discern what is good and what is bad. Yeah. And that's why you see arguments in scientific literature, which I love. I'm a girl, so I like drama. Like, it is what it is. But that's how they're moving forward and getting close. Somebody presented evidence to say, actually, I think we need to challenge what we know about XYZ. And then somebody else can say, yeah, but your evidence isn't good. You should look at this evidence. And that's how we get closer to the truth. So now you guys can kind of start to see why I'm very much about, we need to have discussions about things that we disagree about. That's a personal thing on all levels, but particularly in vet med, just blind acceptance of what somebody from upon high has told you. If they don't have the evidence to support it, it's time to find that evidence. And the other thing, so primary literature, typically, because it's original research, they're going to be testing hypotheses to find a relationship. And how, and so like I said, most research starts with, research in science starts with a question or a hypothesis. And so what that question is, the population in hand, that's going to dictate what kind of research you're going to do. And so one way that we look at research is it's observational or experimental. And observational is I always imagine a scientist in a field counting butterflies. It's literally just looking at the environment around you. You're documenting and collecting information, but you're not actually manipulating anything. This kind of research has to be done for certain things. So if it is unethical or if it is impossible to manipulate certain variables, then you're going to use an observational study. And a great example of this is smoking and cancer. There has not been an experiment on people to determine that smoking cigarettes causes cancer because it's unethical. If you believe that the possible outcome of your research is that it could be killing people, you could cause cancer in your population, you're not going to do that. It's part of the reason why we also right now are finding difficulty in terms of like long-term effects or fetal effects of marijuana use, right? You're not going to get a group of pregnant women together to be like, look, we're just curious if this is going to like really screw up your fetus. So if you could go ahead and take a bunch of cannabis while you are pregnant, we're going to see what happens to yours. And then we're going to get that control group over there to not do that. And then we're going to compare your babies throughout their lifespan. Like, no. No. So a lot of times when you have to have, when the question at hand could mean something unethical, you're going to use observational studies. We do now know, of course, that smoking and cancer are linked, but it's because you had decades of observational research done from all different directions for us to be able to say like, yeah.
Yeah. So, and this is like a good way to kind of like be like, oh, that's what this is. If you see something that says like a retrospective study.
Right.
That's an observational.
Right? Well, I believe so. Yes.
Yeah. Because it's like, you can't, you're not messing with anything. You're looking at the data and right. observing it. So that's
right. Yeah. And so that's another thing to think about when I read things like they're like, oh, let me think of something like walking bare feet causes cancer, something like that. You know, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the study design. You better believe.
Yeah.
Who wrote it? Who paid for it? Is this primary, secondary, or tertiary? Immediately when I see observational or retrospective, the next words out of my mouth are, I cannot infer causation. So if you're reading one of those articles that says that's clearly observational, clearly retrospective, they have not manipulated any variables and it's a single study and they're trying to tell you this is ergo, this equals this, close the book and put it away. I can, no responsible scientist is going to get to that conclusion. They're usually going to say more research needed. Here's the limitations of my study.
Yeah.
This is where we'd like to move forward. Like they should have a bit of humility in terms of what their results meant. And an experimental kind of the same way. They're very, experimental, you can infer causation, but you're still typically not going to get that with one study, and that we can talk about why. But this is when you're trying to infer causation of any sort, it better have moved out of the observational and into the experimental. And that's the other thing that I like, is that observational studies are really great starting points. Like I said, they're great starting points for negotiations where you have a question, something doesn't seem right. You gather a lot of data and go, ooh, well, that's an interesting association. And then you can design experiments to test why there is an association. Association means nothing. We'll talk about that later too.
Yeah.
And to your point, yes, retrospective versus prospective. Retrospective, a lot of times, is going to be, I mean, you can kind of manipulate and control for certain variables. Like if you're in, if you're familiar with the NHANES, you can like download all kinds of cool metrics. And then you can run an experiment, you can manipulate variables. But yeah, you're not going to really get to much causation. Prospective experiments where you can manipulate variables is going to be more likely, you know, where you're going to find causation. And then numbers versus feelings. This was a hard thing for me to get over because for me, numbers are objective. That's where it's at. You absolutely have to. But there's value to both qualitative and quantitative, right? Like not everything is about numbers. You can't turn a person into numbers. So I believe it was NC State several years ago, they published this really great study where they talked about quality of life measures for dog owners of seizure patients. And that's a great example of a qualitative study where we can take that information and say, oh, actually dogs whose owners had really good support, like client education support and somebody there for them, were less likely to euthanize their dog. Were less likely to perceive their dog as having a poor quality of life when they were appropriately supported by their hospital. So, and that's really what I got. Like, yeah, qualitative can be just as good as quantitative, but yeah, qualitative is going to be more like surveys, feelings, and you can quantify those things as well. Whereas your quantitative is going to be that number, 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 number. But I will warn people that statistics out of context is just statistics out of context. Like you really need to have the information around it. So we'll talk about some study designs of primary literature that goes beyond those different categories. But briefly, I'll talk about secondary literature. This is where you're going to find me most of the time. These are easily identified by the term review in their title, super easy. And they also don't typically have a methods or results section unless, and this is where you'll find me, is in your systematic reviews and meta-analyses, because what those things are essentially research done in a primary research way to provide greater results on a certain topic. I will get into better detail than that, don't worry. And then tertiary literature is, of course, like your textbooks and such. So it's gonna be really, really, really broad. So primary research is extremely focused on answering a question. Secondary research is going to be very focused on a single topic, and it's going to typically include primary research in it to provide that information. And then tertiary is just it's very broad, although it can be as broad as like our McKiernan Vet Tech textbooks. It could be a little bit more focused, like the BSAVA neurology textbook. And it could be even more focused, like we see in the cannabis therapy for vet med textbook. So, but in general, these are going to have a lot of very broad information that goes beyond the scope of primary or secondary research. I do like to talk about statistics because one, statistics are cool, but two, it does help us understand some of the concepts in what we're reading in vet med. So, you know, when we talk about like a population versus a sample, population is the entire group of whatever. So it could be dogs, cats, people, that will be affected by the results of what you're studying, right? So like smoking and cancer obviously is something when we're trying to find that connection, we're talking about all people around the world versus the sample. Now, I obviously can't study every single people on the face of the planet. It's not possible. You have to choose a representative sample of that. How that sample is chosen can infer some degree of bias and can make the results more or less reliable later.
Yeah.
And you know, that's what we talk about with regards to generalizability. If I want to study all dogs on the face of the planet, but I choose a sample of like 10 beagles or 10 dachshunds,
right?
That's not a representative sample, and I should not be generalizing that to all dogs everywhere.
Right.
If I truly wanted a representative sample of all dogs everywhere, I'm one, going to have a very large sample. The smaller the sample size, the less reliable. The greater the sample size, the more reliable the results. But it's also, if I have, even if I had 20,000 beagles, it's still not really representing all dogs everywhere.
Yeah.
I might have really great what we call internal validity, meaning that my study was well done, all of the variables were controlled, everything was perfect. But just because my study went really well doesn't mean that I can generalize that to the greater population at hand. And part of that, there's so much to that. We'll talk about that with like your randomized controlled clinical trials, lab animal, and things like that as well. The other big thing to think about are relationships. So we all know correlation is not causation, but covariation, association, correlation, none of those things are causation. We have ways of measuring those things. So what you'll see are things like a Pearson's R test where it's really much easier with the slides up. So I don't want to spend too much time on statistics, but just know how closely something is associated, not caused, but associated, is usually done with a Pearson's R. So it's that relationship. And the closer to one or negative one it is, the closer those two things are related. The other thing we like to do is talk about something called a p-value. You will find p-values in primary literature. And a p-value is literally the probability that the results that that researcher got is due purely to random chance. Because we don't eliminate that in science or scientific literature. That's why we're always learning. The closer we get to the truth, the better we can get at eliminating random chance. So we typically like to see that number less than 0.05, meaning that there's a less than 5% chance that the results that you received were due to random chance. But the lower the number, the better. And no two p-value, especially if you are of the critical scientific mind, can never truly be zero. I mean, we get pretty darn close sometimes, but it can never truly be zero.
Okay. So we just talked about primary, secondary, tertiary literature and kind of recognizing that, and so much good stuff on science. And then we realized we need to break up this episode. So we're going to stop here.
What a shock. I talked too much.
No, it's totally fine. So we're going to stop this week's episode here. Let you guys ruminate on all the amazing stuff about science and being nerdy and all that. And then what we'll do is Christine and I are going to keep recording because we're on a roll. And then we will talk next week, statistics review kind of stuff. And don't be scared. I don't like statistics. I mean, I like the information. I just don't like doing it. How's that? Because I like that class, I did not have a good teacher. So I was just like, I didn't understand it, which is a whole other conversation. But we'll talk about stat review. And then also, what are the other things we're covering next week that kind of go in here?
Yeah. So we're going to start with the stat review because I'm going to go a little bit deeper into different study designs. I'm not going to go over all study designs, but why some study designs are better for certain situations over others. I'll also talk about the importance of relationships statistically. So, and how you can kind of look at something and be like, really, or that's interesting. I go a little bit over secondary research. Again, it's where you're going to find me. And then we talk about kind of what to use when, a little bit about bias and how that can influence what we're reading, that what's in front of us.
Yeah.
And then we'll go through what's known as crap testing. So I know.
I love your crap testing stuff.
It's not so mine. Fun. Okay.
It is yours because you showed it to me. So it's yours.
Okay. I didn't come up with it, but it's a kind of a quick and dirty way that you can look at research ahead of you to see if this is something you want to use, whether it's because it's a presentation, your VTS application, or anything like that.
Yeah. I'm excited. I know these are heavy episodes because, I mean, it is because we're talking about science and research and stuff like that. But it's also really important for us to understand as we're growing. So that's one of the reasons why I made Christine do these episodes with me. And it's funny because I should have known better that it was going to end up being two.
But I did ask before we got started.
I know. And I was like, it should be fine. I should have remembered. So anyways, we're gonna continue with Christine next week, but I'm excited. Thank you, Christine, for starting with this and for being willing to do the second half with me, which is awesome.
Yeah, just give me to nerd out. That's fine. We're not at the end of the dinosaur joke, so.
Right? So thank you, everybody, for joining us this week. We hope you join us next week with part two. And then, yeah, let us know if you have questions. You can always email me. I'll shoot them over to Christine, get her roped into conversations. And, yeah, have a good week, everybody. Keep getting your worm on. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Internal Medicine for Vet Techs podcast. If you like what you heard, we'd love for you to share with someone you think might enjoy the podcast, and make sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Want to give us a boost? Please leave a review on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher, and we'll be sure to say thank you. Find out everything about us at internalmedicineforvettechs.com. Talk to you next week. Bye.